Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Baseball takes the focus, although the U.S. Open Golf Championship is going on right now. But this is the one time where, after Sunday, from Sunday until football training camp starts, baseball has life to itself. And that's across the board. The majors, where the Kansas City Royals will face the National League in the All-Star game. And also in the minor leagues. I'm very pleased to be joined by a guy that has been joining me on when I've done telecasts of minor league baseball, Jonathan Mayo from MLB.com. Jonathan, welcome back. Great to hear you.
Always good to talk with you, Steve.
All right. Fans around here want to know off the top about, obviously, what the Pirates have done. They started out with Kevin Newman in that rush of shortstops in round one. Then Charlie Hayes' kid was the next guy they took also at the 32nd pick. Overall, do you feel that the Pirates got some interesting prospects that have a chance for development?
Well, always, sure. It's funny, sometimes you have to take a step back from the insanity of especially the later rounds to try to take a look. And the thing with analyzing a draft, is you really don't know for another 4 or 5 or more years what comes out of it. To be honest, I was not a huge Kevin Newman guy. So I was, a little surprised they went in that direction. But there are a lot of scouts who really like him and think he's, a good pure shortstop who can run and defend. So, okay. But I like what later on that Cabrian Hayes, I think was a good pick late in at the end of the first round there at 32. He's got some upside to him and, I like when they go that route. They stayed kind of college heavy after that. But they got like 7 top 200 guys when all is said and done over the top 10 rounds. So, if you look at the top 10 rounds in its totality, I actually think they did pretty well.
The Pirates have had, you look at the current club now, and over time they've been able to get a first overall pick. That's the race. A second overall pick. That's one of the 5 best players in baseball. In the top 5 slots, when they've drafted well. Have you had a sense now they're going further down in the draft how well they've handled it versus when they've had the upper half?
Well, I think it's dependent. I mean, keep in mind, Andrew McCutchen was actually the 11th pick in his draft. That wasn't a top-of-the-draft pick. It remains to be seen. I do like, the 2013 draft when they picked 9 and 14. They were just starting to move their way down. And they got Austin Meadows and Reese McGuire, both of whom have very, very bright futures. And they've been aggressive in going sort of after that high-end talent. Even last year they picked the end of the first round and they went after a high school bat and Cole Tucker, who I quite like also. May not have the kind of upside, but he's the kind of gritty, hard-nosed player that I think people in Pittsburgh will really enjoy. So, the jury is still out on, I think, since they've moved to the latter stage of the first round. We'll have to see, how those guys pan out. But they've always been kind of the best available player, kind of drafting team. And if you keep that mentality, regardless of where you pick, I think it's fine. And this was a good year to not be picking high. There wasn't a whole lot of separation. There was a little bit more depth. So you might find out that, Cabrian Hayes and then, the guys that they got in the second, third, or fourth round may be as good as some of the guys taken in the middle of the first.
Back to Newman for a second. That was part of the rash of shortstops and college shortstops that went in round one. What was it about this particular year where it was at least initially the year of the college shortstop?
Yeah, I think it's just how it panned out. it just was, I think there were 8 total shortstops taken in the first round, which was a record. That includes Brendan Rodgers, the high school shortstop, who was taken number 3 overall. And that certainly is rare. And a lot of them will actually at least be given a chance to stay at shortstop, which I think is even more exceptional, because so often you get a guy even in college who's played shortstop in college, but, you know, Dustin Pedroia played shortstop in college, and no one really thought he was ever going to play shortstop at the big league level, and he moved over to second. But, you know, Dansby Swanson will definitely play shortstop. Alex Bregman, you know, maybe he moves to second eventually, but he's improved enough where you send him out as a shortstop, and those, you know, those are the two guys taken at the very top. Kevin Newman, Richie Martin taken, you know, right near each other by the Pirates and the A's. Both will have a very good chance of staying at shortstop. So, you know, I don't think there's any real reason or explanation as to why. It's just this happened to be a year where that was an area of depth.
Yeah, I think if I recall, Troy Tulowitzki may be the last college shortstop that's in the majors as a shortstop. College first-round pick, maybe.
I'll take your word for that without looking it up. But that was, you know, 10 years ago, so... Yeah. It shows you so often, you know, guys, you know, move. Evan Longoria moved over to third.
Alan Craig was a college shortstop.
Yeah, well, there's certain guys you're like, all right, you know, they have no chance of staying at shortstop. And even Longoria, I think most people knew he would play third when he had played, you know, for Team USA and stuff like that. He had played third in deference to better defensive shortstops. Obviously, he's turned out to be a Gold Glove caliber third baseman, so that's worked out okay for him.
The Phillies took Crawford and then come back this year and take another high school player, Cornelius Randolph. For the Phillies, they're in a really interesting spot, as you and I both know, where they stand, where these drafts are going to become increasingly important for them. So what can you tell me about Randolph?
Sorry. Yeah, it's, you know, it was interesting. A lot of people were wondering what direction they'd go in this year. The new scouting director, John the Almaraz, who had not been an amateur scouting director before. Oftentimes when you have a general manager who's perceived to be on the hot seat, their scouting staff is pointed to go for a safe, quick to the big leagues kind of college guy.
Yep.
You know, because they're trying to save their jobs. Now, last year, they took Aaron Nola, the LSU pitcher, and he's in Double A, and he's been dominant. I would be surprised if he's not in Philadelphia at some point this year, or at least I feel he should be. So that worked out. So a lot of people said, well, maybe they'll do that again. But to their credit, they went with the bat and Cornelius Randolph, that was number 10 overall this year. And I mean, he can really hit. And I think he's the kind of hitter, even though he's a high schooler, who, you know, there's talk that they're going to move him out to left field, just let the bat carry him. He could move fairly quickly, even for a high school. I mean, J.P. Crawford, the high school shortstop you referenced, just got moved up to Double A. He has the makings of being an all-star caliber player. So sometimes just going with the best available player and not worrying, well, is he going to get to the big leagues fast or not, is still the best way to go, because if it's a special high school player, then he has a chance to still get there kind of quickly and then maybe be a higher impact kind of guy.
Yeah, they went, Kingery in the next round, Lucas Williams.
Yep.
After that, then Kyle Martin. They went all infield first, two shortstops and a second baseman in the opening 4 picks.
Right, and Randolph isn't going to play shortstop.
Right.
I think some people think he could play third, and maybe the Phillies look at that, you know, during instructs and things like that, but they're going to send him out as a left fielder and just let him hit and then figure it out from there. And Kingery is a second baseman who's athletic enough to move out to the outfield. There's a nice mix of college and high school guys kind of mixing and matching. I think, you know, Kingery is a guy who could get there really quickly with a very advanced approach at the plate, and he can run a little bit too. He's a good little player, especially for, you know, a college performer type.
I think the only first-round pick the Cardinals have ever sent here was actually Adam Ottavino. And of course, now he's undergone Tommy John after being the closer for the Rockies. He went high school again with Nick Plummer with the 23rd overall pick. What was the scouting report on Plummer?
Well, you know, Plummer kind of, I won't say he came out of nowhere, but he came out of nowhere over the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Because he plays in Michigan. The guy's in the cold weather state. Sometimes it's a little hard to be seen. And people didn't, he didn't have much of a profile. He wasn't one of these famous guys, you know, even before he became a senior. And, he was tremendous pretty much all summer against really good competition, terrific bat speed, can really hit. Didn't have a great spring. It was tough because you got to wait for it to warm up. You think we have it bad here, you know, and he's in Michigan. He didn't get to play a ton of baseball. He had one game against, and the level of competition isn't good, so he had one game against a good pitcher, and he struggled with a lot of people watching him, and that probably knocked him out of the, you know, sort of conversation of some of those high school outfielders that went in the teens. But that worked out to the Cardinals' favor. Yeah, they stayed high school early on. Their first three picks were all high school
they
guys.
They sure did, yeah. Woodford and
then they got Harrison Bader in the third round, the Florida, and I could see him. It depends what they want to do. Now, he's still playing baseball.
Yeah,
Florida
he's,
is still
he's
in the
coming
cultural
here.
Series.
Yeah, he's probably coming here. So,
right. It's just they're not done in Omaha yet. So we won't see him on Sunday for our telecast.
No, we won't.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, but, we won't. And they won again last night. He played well again last night. I think he homered last night.
Yes, he did.
Yeah, what do you think? What do you think of Bader? He was the 100th overall pick in this draft.
I like him. You know, he's got some tools. He can hit. He's really confident. You know, obviously playing for a really good program. You know, guys like that, it remains to be seen whether or not he's an everyday outfielder or, you know, maybe a really good fourth outfielder. But, you know, people said that about A.J. Pollock. And he's turned into a pretty good everyday big league outfielder. So I think he's got some of the offensive upside that could turn him into an everyday outfielder. Now, if he can stick in center, you know, I think he might have the speed to be able to. I know I think he's mostly played left for Florida, but, you know, he probably is capable of playing all three. This summer it'd be interesting. Maybe they just leave him in left and then try him in center next year to see if they can, you know, find an everyday center fielder out of him.
I've rattled off a series of names, and when you and I have done broadcasts, I feel the comfort level where I can throw out virtually any name and you have something. How?
Well,
I'm just telling you my perception. Okay. Because there's so many names here.
Right.
Can you give everybody just a little insight into your job, how you develop at least nuggets on, well, I perceive it to be everybody on as many guys as possible.
Right. Yeah, it's not. I have a lot of notes, you know. I talk to a lot of scouts. I get a lot of scouting reports. So I have a lot of resources at my fingertips, which help. Now, in getting ready for the draft, I'll probably have a good familiarity with we do a top 200 ranking.
Right.
It's not that I'll have automatic recall, but if I look at a guy for 4 seconds, I'll remember already, you know, oh yeah, he's a fastball slider guy out of the bullpen, or oh yeah,
sure,
he's got some speed in center field. And the way I work very closely with Jim Callis at MLB.com, and the way we split up the lists is we do it kind of geographically. So, a guy like Harrison Bader, for instance, I had Florida.
Okay.
So I knew him better than most. Nick Plummer I happened to see over the summer at the East Coast Pro Showcase, so I had familiarity with him.
Okay.
So I don't get out to see guys as much as I'd like to, Steve, but, you know, a little bit of that combined with just networking and talking to a lot of people, scouts who are the ones out there racking up the miles in their cars and frequent flyer miles and things like that to go see these players. I rely on them heavily for good information.
There are a lot of people today that will use analytics, and, you know, and analytics are important. I mean, the analytics I think are important in game preparation and so forth, you know, where you want to position players, but they'll also use analytics when it comes to a draft. What percentage do you look at numbers yourself, and how much do you rely either on what you personally see or what a scout you trust tells you?
I will always rely on a scout.
Yeah.
Vantage point before mine. I'm not one who pretends to be a scout or thinks he's a scout. Now, I've seen enough baseball where if something's pointed out to me, I get it and I see it.
Yes.
But I don't evaluate players. Now, if we're, you know, when Jim and I are going through and coming up with our rankings, and, you know, all things are equal, we get a feel for a guy, whether we like a guy. Scott Kingery is a guy that I like quite a bit. Now, I've never actually seen him. That was just solely based on talking to people that I really trust, you know, scouting director types. Analytics have, you know, are a part of it, especially for college players where you at least have a fair amount of data. Mm-hmm. I think as long as it's just part of the one piece of the puzzle and not the whole puzzle, because obviously the college game is different and you have to take into account the conference they're in and the ballpark they're in and all the things that come into play when you're doing that at the minor league or even the major league level, I think it's a valuable tool, you know, as long as it's combined with, you know, the quote-unquote good old-fashioned scouting and evaluation.
Well, I can't wait to see you on Sunday night, my friend. We'll have a good time working the broadcast again this year.
Well, we better. My wife isn't pleased on missing Father's Day for this, so it's all good. It better be a good one.
Well,
no pressure.
Then I better ramp up some good stuff for you.
Hey. All right, sounds good.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Jonathan Mayo, MLB.com. Interesting what he said about Scott Kingery, wasn't it? That's the Philly second pick, Kev. He really likes that pick a lot.
I'm keeping my fingers crossed.
Well, but he also indicated that he thinks there's an avenue where his trek through the system to get to Citizens Bank Park might not be a long one. Interesting. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
All three deals are neck and neck as they come down to the finish line. And they're all tied at 19-9-15. Looks like at SMC, everyone's the winner.
It's the Sunbury Motors Ford Triple Crown of Savings. Choose from either a new 2015 Ford Escape or the fuel-efficient Ford Fusion or a 2015 Ford Focus equipped with heated leather seats and a power moonroof for an amazing price of $19,915. You heard right. A new 2015 Ford Escape, a 2015 Ford Fusion, or top-of-the-line Ford Focus for just $19,915. Sunbury Motors has over 250 new Fords available with savings up to $10,000 and interest rates as low as 0% for up to 72 months.
View the entire inventory online at sunburymotors.com.
The Triple Crown sale won't last long, so hurry in to Sunbury Motors. Satisfying more customers and selling more cars for over a century. Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza. Proudly owned by the Mertz family since 1915.
Head to Biter's Home Center today for our huge Father's Day sale and shop with 0% interest financing for 1 year. We have great gift ideas for Dad at Super Father's Day Savings. Help Dad keep his man cave or workshop dry with an Energy Star 30-pint dehumidifier, only $149. A dad that hunts will surely appreciate a 7.1 cubic foot capacity chest freezer for only $188. And Dad can stay cool and comfortable with a Frigidaire Energy Star 10,000 BTU air conditioner, now $249 at all Biter's Home Centers. Plus, we have a home stretch deluxe Big Man's Chase rocker recliner in his choice of colors, only $399. And give Dad his grill and let him eat steak, too. Just purchase any Weber gas grill at Biter's Home Center and receive a deluxe steak package. And make Dad feel like the king he is with the Biter's exclusive pillow top king bedding set for only $566. So go to Biter's.com or visit our Facebook page to check out our flyer. Then hurry to one of Biter's five convenient locations now through 5 p.m. Sunday for our huge Father's Day sale.
See store for complete financing details.
A lot of future talk there with Jonathan Mayo of MLB.com as we went through draft choices from last week's MLB draft, a draft that I feel was ultra important to the future of the Philadelphia Phillies. And first-round pick probably doesn't end up playing shortstop, may end up playing outfield or third base. Kingery, the second-round pick, could be a second baseman, also could play outfield. You have more glowing things to say about the second-round pick than the first pick. Found that to be interesting. They drafted two shortstops with their first four picks. Neither one's going to end up playing shortstop.
That's promising. And I know why. I just thought it was funny. because I had read that somewhere else, too.
Yeah, but I mean, Crawford is expected to be the shortstop of the future. Roman Quinn is a really good player, Kevin. He's going to probably play second base. You know, Roman Quinn is either going to be a second baseman or converted to a center fielder with his speed. Okay, Roman Quinn is not going to play shortstop. Crawford's going to be the shortstop of the future. And so it's like Evan Longoria was a shortstop in college. But as soon as he got the Team USA, they put him at third base, and that's where he's been. He's a gold glove third baseman. Alan Craig came here. He was a shortstop. I remember they put him at shortstop initially. And Mark Dijon, DJ, looks at me and he says, he can't play shortstop. I said, that's why they created the other eight positions to move to. And they put him at third base and they put him in the outfield. Well, you know, the guy ended up being an all-star. Major League Baseball all-star. Well, I mean, look, you move all over the place in these things. I mean, Mookie Betts is the starting center fielder for the Red Sox. When I saw him at Lowell, he was playing second base. It's what you need.
I just like the name what Mookie.
And the show heads.
No, I'm just saying, that's a great name. You have to admit, Mookie's a great name.
Sure. Yep. Mookie's a great name.
Hey, you can shorten it up to Mook.
His actual name is Marcus, okay?
I know that, but I like Mookie better.
This 5-minute news break will be good for me.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Great to be with you, Sunbury Motors. 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Key, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Onward State was able to get an interview, Alex Robinson did, with Kirk Herbstreit. And it was an interesting interview because it's one thing for me to sit here and lend perspective on what I see with Penn State. And there will be some people that will say, well, yeah, Steve's the play-by-play guy, so he's going to see it a certain way. And as incorrect or as unfair as that might be, I also understand the perception. You know, if you don't want to respect that someone's been around the block a few times and see certain things, that's your prerogative as a listener. It's up to you. So, but I understand that. And sometimes when an outside entity then ends up saying the same things that you do, you want to at least point it out for a couple reasons. Onward State talked to Kirk Herbstreit, whom I feel is about as objective an analyst as there is out there in college football. I know some people say, oh, he's Ohio State, he leans that way. You know what? That's his alma mater. Yeah, he played there. But remember, these aren't the same coaches. It's not the same anything as when he was there. And he was there 20 years ago with John Cooper. Longer than that, 25 years ago, or, you know, way back. Earl Bruce. And his objective is to be objective. And I have a lot of respect for him. So Onward State, and again, credit to Alex Robinson. It's a two-part, and this was from part one. He asked him about the victory Penn State had over Boston College in the Pinstripe Bowl. Let's go back to December when everybody was saying, I don't care if they win. Not everybody. There were several people saying, I don't care if they win. It's more, it's a practice. It's a practice, practice. And I said repeatedly, the practice is really important, but winning the game is really important. Really important. Not just somewhat important or a nice addendum because you got the extra practice. I said repeatedly, winning the game was really important because it jumpstarts you into the winter program. It changes the attitude. I've been around teams where after losing the bowl game, you got to pick yourself up off the table and get yourself going, kind of force yourself to do some things. I've seen that in players over repeatedly, as opposed to winning the bowl game, and they can't wait to get to the weight room and start attacking next year because they feel they're building on something. And that's why I said in December over and over again, winning the game was really important. The practice part was obviously critical, but winning the game was really important. Herb Street, in the interview with Onward State, he said, I think the biggest thing is last season was an up-and-down season just based on their own expectations. I think to be able to end it with a win, and I think that's something that is undervalued by many, is winning that second or third-tier bowl game. When you win it, it creates such an energy in your program. It carries over to the winter program and eventually to spring bowl. Then he'd say he had great words to say about Bill O'Brien, great things to say about James and what they're trying to build. Now we get to the sanction part. And Alex Robinson asked him from Onward State, a lot of NCAA sanctions were reduced significantly, but the team is still under the scholarship limit by a handful of scholarships and isn't playing at 100% health and depth yet. Many people have used that as an excuse to justify the team's struggles last year and before. What do you think it will take for Penn State to compete in the Big Ten and nationally? How long do you think it will take? Kirk Herbstreit. And tell me where you've heard this before. When I talk about all the teams, I just talk about based on my own opinion and a lot of research and watching a lot of these teams. I think excuse, and by the way, excuse was put in quotations, I think excuse is a pretty strong word to use to talk about the sanctions and the lack of scholarships. That's reality. That's not an excuse. They were hit hard, and hard, by the way, was put in capital letters. They were hit hard with sanctions, and even some of their own players left. He mentioned Silas Red, Kevin Hapley, and Anthony Farrah. So not only could they not go out and get new players, that's because of the scholarship reduction, but some of their own players weren't even there. I'm not living and dying with Penn State football like some of your fans are, but I've really been impressed by what they've done despite the reductions in scholarships. I don't think people realize how much that guts you as a program when you lose all those scholarships and how hard it is. It's already hard with 85 scholarships, let alone what Penn State's been playing with the last two seasons. I'm talking about how many guys that you have after injuries and red shirts and how many guys are suiting up. To which Alex Robinson, to his credit, follows up right away and mentions there were about 50 players available each week during the season by our count, give or take, and James Franklin said the team was down to 41 players before the bowl game. Kirk Herbstreit jumps in. That's such a disadvantage. That's not an excuse. That's reality. I think what I've noticed is Penn State, Miami, Florida, USC, and other schools that have been hit hard by this kind of penalty, the area impacted the most is always the offensive line. So, and then they mentioned Penn State starts with Temple, then has five straight home games. He says that's huge. That's first 5 or 6 weeks. If they're able to win games and create some confidence and stay healthy, then they've got a primetime game in Columbus that becomes an interesting game. Then they go into other things about game day and so forth, which has been a gold standard. And then they'll have part two of it tomorrow. But I want to point that out. Again, things that we talk about here all the time in trying to lend perspective as to what's going on around here. There is no magic wand to what happens in Penn State's situation. The sanctions are not an excuse. The sanctions have been a reality here. And the one area where Penn State fans have justifiably been spoiled over the years is there have been very few times where the word process has been needed to talk about where Penn State football is going. Joe did such an incredible job, and Bill O'Brien wasn't here really long enough, where you have to talk about the process of getting yourself into the top five again. Yes, you know, there's certainly some dips along the way. You know, 75 was okay, 76 was the dip, 77 come right back, 78 play for the national championship, 79 kind of slide back, 80 all of a sudden you're coming back. 81, I've always kind of had a gut feeling I felt the 81 team was a little bit better than maybe the 82 team, but then 82 won it. Then 83, you know, okay, you kind of slide back. 84, you're down, boom, 85, you play for the championship. 86, you play for the championship. 87, good. 88 to down. Now you start to feel, nine, you know, 89, they're coming back. 90, they beat Notre Dame. 91, they're third in the country. You dip a little bit in 92. Then 93, you start the Big Ten. And, yeah, you lose to Ohio State, Michigan, but you end up, you win the bowl game. You get that jump, and they go to 94, and they crush everybody. You know, then you get to 95, slide back a little bit. 96 is a good year. You get to the Fiesta Bowl, which was really the first, like, even though it wasn't called the BCS, that was the first true BCS years with higher payouts. So that was a big get to get to the Fiesta Bowl. 97, you know, they kind of let that one slip away a little bit. 98 was all right. 99, you know, they start out 9-0, they let it slip. Then, of course, then we hit 2000, which is not good. 2001, not good. 2002, good year. 3-4, not good. Then, boom, right back. 5, they win 11 games. They win 9-6. They win 9-7. They win 11 games in 8. They win 11 games in 9. You know, there just have not been prolonged dips in this program for fans to endure where process has really been talked about at all. It's always been, you know, the taking the time to reload and get back going again to get back to the top and get a couple years back to back where they're right back at the top of the mountain or fighting to be at the top of the mountain. So process is something that we have talked about in basketball terms. Process is something that we've talked about over the years before Cale got here, the process of getting to a national championship in wrestling. Process is not really something we've talked about in football. This is really the first true process time. And what they've done in this program in the last 3 years, despite everything that was thrown at them to try and gut the program, they still won 22 games. Not one time in 3 years did they finish below 500. And in talking with Bill O'Brien repeatedly in 12, and I've related the story many times, the 2 years that he really, really was worried about were 14 and 15. And I told everybody in last year's speaking, when I went around, I did a dozen speaking engagements last year. I was very blunt with everybody about, hey, look, Bill felt that 14 was a year that really concerned him because that's when the scholarship sanctions would really hit. And just because they got some scholarships back doesn't mean like, oh, okay, everything's fine again. Everything is not fine again. It's in the process of getting back to where it was. And you still have to deal with at this time, and I've had a number of people complain about the non-conference schedule. the non-conference schedule was put together back in 12, for the most part. Most of it was put together in 12 with the idea that I'm really worried about 14 and 15. So you're trying to pick up some wins here along the way. That's why you schedule in the way you schedule.
I don't know how many times you and I have talked about it, but you know what I don't think fans realize, they're trying to put together a schedule playing FBS football with FCS numbers of scholarships.
Right, and that's what they were thinking they were going to have now. The thought was in 14 and 15, you'd have 65 scholarships with 15 available each year to give. Well, now things have changed a bit. But you're still incredibly imbalanced scholarship-wise on this team in this process of getting back. Look, you need depth, so you have to go out and get as many players as you can depth-wise on the football team. And thus, of the 78 recruited scholarship players in this team, 39, half of them, are either freshmen or redshirt freshmen. You don't quite have the balance of numbers that you want to have in the offensive line on scholarships. James doesn't have the balance of scholarships he wants to have at quarterback. He'd like to have five scholarship quarterbacks. He's got three. Every coach has their
comfort zone.
Not comfort zone. Every coach has what they perceive to be their own positional balance. Bill O'Brien felt there were too many offensive linemen on scholarship here. So it fit in with him wanting to pare that back anyway. That's an NFL mentality. The NFL carries, you know, the Steelers go to play a game. The Eagles go to play a game. They only have seven offensive linemen, you know.
If you're a Steeler fan, you know that well.
No, but I'm saying, but that's what you have. I don't think a lot of fans realize that. You don't have 10 offensive linemen.
Well, what I mean is you've seen what can happen when a couple of guys go down in a game for the Steelers a few years ago.
And that's what, you know, and he brought that mentality here. Well, that's not James Franklin's mentality. Bill O'Brien wanted more wideouts. He wanted three quarterbacks. And he felt that they had too many offensive linemen and not enough defensive backs. Every coach has their own comfort level on positional balance. Well, James Franklin's trying to now get his balance put in place here. But you're also going to go through a cycle where at some point what's happened in 13 and what happened in 12 and 13 is going to catch up to you in the recruiting trail down the road here, because you've had to play catch up in two classes. You're going to be heavy on those two classes and not able to reload there's going to be one class in particular that's going to be really down in terms of the numbers that they have coming up. See, and that's where this cycle comes in. It's not normal here yet. And I think everyone has watched over this the last 3 years where they've seen Penn State be able to beat Wisconsin a couple times, beat Michigan in four overtimes, go out and, you know, and win some of the games that won, win the bowl game, beat Central Florida, where everybody's like, hey, you know, things are normal. They aren't normal. They aren't even, you know, they're on the path to normal, but they're not normal yet. And they're probably, I'd say, a couple years away from being in a position where, okay, now you feel like the program is functioning, you know, outside of it, you know, injuries which come into play or other factors, which are just normal things that hit in any program. You know, so Alabama to drop a guy this week, for example. But Penn State is not to that normal area yet. And the fans have been tremendous, tremendous. The NCAA, hey, they'll get 30 or 40,000 people there. They'll fall off. They haven't fallen off. Not even close. Not even close. They've been instrumental in winning games and instrumental in recruiting. It's been a great partnership between the program and the fans, and vice versa. But there's also a sense for some, not many, but for some, well, I don't understand why. I don't understand. Okay. These aren't excuses. These are realities. And in this process of bringing the program back, I think they've done a good job of accelerating the process as much as you can possibly do it. This will be a fun year to watch in a lot of ways, which will be another important step in the process. We'll wrap it up in a moment here on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Wrapping up for the day, Ryan Howard hit a two-run homer today as the Phillies beat the Orioles 2-1. The Twins beat the Cardinals 2-1. Joe Mauer homered in the eighth inning, and Kenny Vargas was able to knock in the game winner in the ninth. So the Pirates have a chance to pick up a game. They play the White Sox tonight with their ace, Gerrit Cole, on the mound, and Jeff Smarja will go for the White Sox. At the U.S. Open, Dustin Johnson bogeyed the last, which turned out to be the ninth hole today for him. He started on the back nine. And this will be the leaderboard tomorrow, I am confident. I don't think the afternoon guys are going to be able to challenge this. Henrik Stenson and Dustin Johnson each shot 5 under par 65s today. Matt Kuchar shot a 367. Patrick Reed is playing the last. He's at 3 under. Cody Gribble and Francisco Molinari each shot 68 today. Jason Duffner also is at 2 under. Phil Mickelson, Kevin Chappell, Brant Snedeker, Colin Montgomery, and Brian Herman all shot 69 today. And I think Miguel Jimenez has a chance to join along with Kevin Na. You're not going to get scores like this in the afternoon. The course is running fast now. It's dried out. And I think the afternoon guy is going to be at a complete disadvantage. Just like this group I just mentioned, they play the late round tomorrow, so they'll be the ones at the disadvantage. You know, when you have a chance to get some water on the course overnight, it gives you a shot when you play earlier to score. And the group that plays this afternoon will not have that opportunity, but they will have the opportunity tomorrow. And yes, Tiger Woods tees off at 5:28.
Tiger on the twos.
Well, I can tell you right now, he may not get out of the twos. He may not play the weekend.
He may only get to play 2 days.
Rory McIlroy, 2 over, by the way. He shot a 72 today. Not the start he wanted.